Welcome to The Swing.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Berkshire Miller.
And I'm Yaroslav Baran. Today, we're going to talk about the foreign policy focus of the new Canadian government. We've got the G7 summit coming up. We've got the G7 finance ministers already underway in Banff. So we're going to talk about how foreign policy is emerging and to what degree it's going to be a priority for the newly sworn in cabinet. So, Jonathan, this is your first time on the pod, so just maybe take a moment to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thanks a lot, Yaron. It's a real pleasure to be on this podcast. I'm a big fan listening to some of the previous episodes. So I'm a recovered former public servant, a think tanker, and focus on all things geopolitics here in Canada. And my favorite title, of course, is now as a co-founder and principal here of the new geopolitical advisory housed within the Pendulum Group.
Right. Well, thanks again for joining us, Jonathan. All right. Listen, this is going to be Mark Carney's first G7 summit. It's a high profile summit coming up in June. It's going to be a major focus of government attention. Preparing for it, prep has actually been underway for several months. What are the stakes involved?
Well, so I think it's a really important summit for Prime Minister Carney. It's his first large international summit. And I think there's a few different things that we can look to. First of all, I mean, I think it's interesting to turn to his single mandate letter that he mentioned. And a couple of those points relate to foreign policy. The first point coming out of the gates, and we saw this ahead of his election victory, was focus on the Can-US relationship. And the reason I reference this in the G7 context is I think Mark Carney and his team is sort of breathing a bit of a sigh of relief that they had the initial summit with U.S. President Donald Trump out of the way before the G7 summit. So, of course, Canada-U.S. relations will play into dynamics in the summit. I think every member of the G7 and their relationship with the U.S. will play into some dynamics of this summit. But the fact that it's not the entire focus of the G7 summit, I think, is important in its own right. That they've had that first meeting, they may not have agreed to much, but they've come out of it with some level of personal connectivity, I think, is a good starting point. The second point, the last point I'll leave before sort of getting on to our next questions, Yaro, is that one of the silver linings, of course, of the antagonistic relationship that we have now with our southern neighbor is that Canadians are waking up a little bit more on foreign policy and defense. So we see, of course, a desire to diversify with some of our partners in Europe and Asia. We see a renewed push to be more principled on national defense. And this is something that has been lagging for well over a decade. So all of these, I think, are positive signs if they're channeled in the right direction.
All right. Well, look, you mentioned the mandate letter. It's an interesting move. We saw a single omnibus mandate letter being issued by the Prime Minister to all of Cabinet. And I'll just summarize the priorities. First, strike a new security and economic deal with the U.S. Second, remove internal trade barriers. Third, tackle affordability. Fourth, build more homes with even more trade workers. Protect Canada's sovereignty by strengthening its defense, reform immigration, and cut government spending. So this is largely an internally focused, a domestic policy focused agenda that we're going to see from the Carney government. And, you know, it comes on the heels of affordability having been a major theme in the lead up to the federal election and during the federal election. Overall, how much should we expect foreign policy to be a priority, to be a focus for Carney's team?
Well, I think first, I mean, just a quick comment on the mandate letter itself. I mean, I think it's a display of the different personal politics between Mark Carney and Justin Trudeau. I mean, obviously, Justin Trudeau putting the mandate letters out for each minister. I think this is a more crisp, concise, action-oriented, very to the point letter. It's still aspirational in nature. I mean, you look at every one of those sort of points and you could say, well, look, I mean, that's easy to say. It's easy to say that we have a better relationship with the United States, that we reform our military, et cetera, et cetera. Doing it is harder. But I think there's a very clear road plan that I think he's set out there. On foreign policy, I do think that he's going to focus on it. But I think my one concern and one caveat here is that everything being premised around the Canada-US relationship is not necessarily a good thing. So I think Canada needs to realize that some of the challenges, be it a revisionist Russia in Europe, be it a revisionist China in Asia, these are challenges that face Canadian interests, regardless of what's happening with the United States. So I haven't seen a whole lot of discussion on this. Yes, we know Mark Carney has visited Europe a couple of times already and seems to be supportive of our Ukrainian friends as an example. But making sure that this foreign policy is not just purely centered on hedging away from the US and more of a principled engagement globally. I think that's what I'm really looking for.
Leads to my next question. Like, this is the G7 summit coming up in June. You know, there have been some kind of murmurings and whisperings in the lead up saying this could be the last G7. And some people, whether pessimistically or optimistically, suggesting that we may move back to a G8, and others suggesting that, you know, we might have a G6 going forward. How stable do you think this forum is? And do you think it will stand the test of time under current geopolitical circumstances?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think Canada's had a little bit of an unlucky draw recently on G7 summits. I mean, we had the last one in 2018 during Trump 1.0, and we know that sort of ended with President Donald Trump sort of tearing up the communique in the airplane on the way home. We hope for a better result this time. On the broader issue of the future of G7, look, I think that there are challenges, of course. There are new challenges, especially in the relationship with the U.S. and many of the other members. I do have some faith in the organization for a couple of reasons. Number one, if you think about other international institutions, so other alternatives, to give you an example, the other G is the G20, which is focused more on geoeconomic issues. And outside of the post-financial crisis in 2008, the G20 has proven to be very divisive. Part of that reason, of course, has been the fact that Russia and China are members of it. And now we've seen Russia with its illegal reinvasion of Ukraine, it being very difficult to have productive discussions in the G20 context. So while the G7 is not perfect, generally, even though we might be in an anomaly of time right now, it is a group of like-minded countries who can get together and share, while not perfect mirror images of themselves, a good view on political security issues. So I do have some faith on it going forward. My last sort of point, though, is that, you know, we worry, of course, about the ruminations of G8 and bringing Russia back. But I think G7 also needs to evolve in many ways. And there have been proposals to actually involve more like-minded democracies or more countries that would hedge in with the values of G7. Examples of this in the previous years are countries like South Korea, like Australia, potentially even India. So I think the idea of whether it may not be permanent G7 expansion, but involving more players into G7, I think would be a good idea.
Now, de facto, the G7 has already become bigger than the G7, hasn't it? I mean, who, for example, right now we've had the G7 finance ministers meeting in Banff, and, you know, for instance, Ukraine's finance minister, Minister Marchenko, was present. How significant is that? And around the summit itself in June, when we have heads of government and heads of state convening, it is not going to be only the heads of state and heads of government of those seven countries. So who are some of the others coming, and what's the significance of that broadening of the tent? Is it a good move? Is it inevitable?
I think it's a good move, both globally, a good and a necessary move, both globally and also for Canada. So going back to, you know, what Canada needs to do and how Canada needs to engage in the world. Look, the easy answer and the easy thing, I think, for any Canadian prime minister, especially in times now where we have challenges with, of course, Russia and China, and unfortunately right now with the United States, the easy answer is to say, look, let's do more with the European Union. Let's do more with Japan and South Korea, which are like-minded democracies. No one's going to disagree with that. I won't disagree with that. I think that's a fantastic idea. But I think we need to be a bit more broader in our engagement. And globally, that's the case too. So that brings up some of the countries that I expect to be invited. I haven't heard formally on this, but I think this is an interesting test to the way that Mark Carney wants to govern in foreign policy terms. And some of those names, I think, will be Narendra Modi. Whether he accepts or not, I think, is going to be interesting. But considering the challenges in the Canada-India relationship, I think that's a fascinating, and I think it's the right choice and the right move, but I think it's a bold move. I also heard that we'll be inviting folks from the Middle East, potentially including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Again, very good and necessary moves, despite, of course, the challenges as well. So I think we need to be a little bit more creative and dynamic with thinking about where are the capital pools? How can we engage more broadly beyond this sort of very narrow global West sort of viewpoint?
It's really changed a lot in its planning, hasn't it? I mean, the planning, it started under former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and his vision was that this is going to be a small, intimate gathering just of those seven leaders so that they can have frank discussions. It seems to be really ballooning into something much bigger, but that might be precisely what the circumstances call for. Now, let me focus for a second and get your read on Canada's new foreign affairs minister, Anita Anand. She, as we all know, is previously Canada's defense minister. She knows defense well. She gets defense. She's been very active in defense. Some have suggested that this is a sign of a significantly more muscular foreign policy for Canada going forward and potentially a departure from the kind of traditional broad multilateralism. Everything must go through the UN, you know, on principle, for example, rather than sort of securing alliances of the countries that make sense to tackle any particular problem, sort of a building coalitions of the willing. What's your read on what to expect with her as foreign minister?
Well, I think it's a great question. I think there's a glass half full, glass half empty view. So, I mean, on one side, from what I've heard, and you know, I think this matches from what I've seen of her, especially in the defense portfolio, I think you're right, Yara. I think she's a sober-minded, pretty clear-headed, pretty logical in her thinking. Of course, it wasn't a perfect tenure at defense, but I think she's well-respected by a lot of Canada's allies in NATO and also in the Indo-Pacific. So I think that's a positive sign. I think it's also potentially a positive departure from a little bit more of an ideological foreign minister in Melanie Joly. So I think it'll be a departure of personality in a little ways, and going back to the business style of doing things. The challenge there, I think, that she'll find as a personality there is that the defense file, and whether it's Treasury Board or other things that she's held, are different from the foreign ministry file. There's a lot of things that will hit you in the face on a random Friday or a random Tuesday, and you are in the thick of it. So it's not, while there's challenges in the defense portfolio, be it, for example, you know, the conflict in Gaza, be it Ukraine, be it China, be it the Can-US relationship, she will have to find her way as far as dealing with the media, dealing with many different stakeholders. And I think that's something she's still feeling her way through.
Okay. Well, other ministers, we've got a new defense minister as well, Minister McGuinty. I think we should probably expect a pretty seamless transition from his previous role in public safety. And of course, before that, he was a longstanding chair of NSICOP. So this is not a foreign world to him. But also interestingly, in the cabinet shuffle, we saw that there was an establishment of a new post, Secretary of State position, specifically for government procurement. Do you think that's going to help streamline and focus defense procurement? Because that's going to be a pretty major imperative, given that official government policy is now hitting 2% GDP defense spending by 2030.
I think so. Aspirationally, I think that's definitely the motivation, and I hope that it's true. I mean, anyone who can fix Canadian procurement would be an instant millionaire. But I think I do think that's the aspiration. I do think there's actually a benefit in the idea of taking part of this responsibility away from defense. That being said, decisions will have to be very much cohesively coordinated with the defense minister. Also, something we haven't been able to touch on yet, but is the role of the National Security Council, which is something Trudeau created. But whether Mark Carney will reform this at all, what role that might play in procurement, I think all of these are really interesting things that need to be ironed out. And I would say that it comes at a very critical time, Yaro, as you mentioned, with the 2% spending cut. We've pledged to have a significant bid on submarines and many different kits and capabilities. So right now we need to figure this out ASAP. So this is the step in the right direction.
Now, some machinery clarity was published by the Privy Council Office several days ago. And it appears that Minister Fuhr, in his role as procurement minister for defense, is actually going to be reporting to the Minister of Public Works and Procurement rather than to the Minister of National Defense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I think that in this scenario, as long as there's a coordinated discussion, as said, with defense and probably with the National Security Council, I actually think it could be a positive. But we've seen on other agreements, for example, logistics agreements, defense intelligence sharing agreements, that procurement has actually found itself in the lead with, even though they're traditionally defense agreements, there's been challenges there. So, you know, on paper, it makes sense, but I think how that's ironed out between the two ministries, I think could be problematic.
All right, final point is back to that 2% GDP defense spending target. I mean, we do now have a target to hit that spending threshold by 2030, but just as Canada is finally waking up and growing up and reading the room and making that commitment, there is a movement afoot among NATO partners to raise that floor up to 3.5% minimum spending requirement. So the floor is moving. Canada is aggressively, constantly trying to keep up. Is there any reasonable prospect of Canada being able to hit that new upcoming target anytime soon?
Well, I don't think that we could hit it anytime soon, but I think that we need to make a commitment towards it. And not just a commitment rhetorically, I think we need to start taking the actions towards it. So the one thing I picked out of Mark Carney's press conference, I think it was yesterday, and he was asked about the quote unquote Golden Dome and missile defense of the United States, is he did mention that the NATO summit's coming up and the budget, which will be tabled in the fall, will take into account some of the commitments from the NATO summit. So read into that what you will. But I think there could be a discussion that 2% was the conversation of the last 5-10 years. Absolutely, I agree. 3% is basically the basement at this point in the discussion. And it looks like NATO is pushing for 3.5 at its recent summit. So I do think that it's something that we're not going to have much of a choice on. I think the Europeans, most of them, are agreeing to sign up to this. The United States will continue to pressure on this. So I think that it's inevitable that we'll be looking north of 3% post NATO summit.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we'll leave it there, and let's do this again as we get closer to summit time, and then we'll have a similar discussion as the NATO summit is coming up. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Sounds good. It was a real pleasure.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.